Does anybody here love a good murder mystery? Tell me, what is one of your all-time favorite murder mystery TV shows or movies, past or present? Somebody tell me. Murder on the Orient Express. What was that other one? Clue. Perry Mason. Murder, She Wrote. That was a good one. How to what? How to Get Away with Her? Whoa. How to Get Away with a Murder. That would be more thematic, yes. As someone mentioned back in the day, some of us used to watch Murder, She Wrote. It was a good show, right? My favorite episode was the one where the office, an office worker got killed and his body was stuffed in a small container. It turns out it was a briefcase. Be careful what you ask for. A good friend of mine told me that she is currently reading a murder mystery novel in Braille. She says the tension is palpable. I personally don't get into murder mysteries that much, but I recently bought a murder mystery puzzle, one of these 1,000-piece puzzles. I'm still trying to piece it together. I've got more where that came. I got a million dad jokes, right? I keep them in a database. I stole that from Jordan White. Blame him. All kidding aside. Today we're launching into a new sermon series that is deadly serious, entitled Who Killed Jesus. The goal of this sermon series will be to determine who bears ultimate responsibility for the death of Jesus. There are many different people who had a motive to want Jesus eliminated. Some will surprise you. Each week we'll look at a different suspect and the case against them, and at the end of this process, you, the jury, can decide who bears ultimate responsibility for the death of Jesus. There'll be some unexpected plot twists, even if you've been in church your whole life. And in the course of this, we're going to learn a lot, I hope, about Jesus, the people around him, ourselves, God, and history. But this is not just an exercise in curiosity. It's not just an intellectual exercise. Because from each of these cases, we're going to learn a really important practical lesson that we can apply to our lives. So, let's start with prayer. God, the ultimate symbol of our faith is the cross. We can't understand our faith without understanding the cross. Yes, we know the basic story, but now we're going to go deeper. Give us insights that will strengthen us spiritually, that will enliven our spirit, that will help us be better followers of Jesus. Help us to get it. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. So, if we were detectives responsible for determining who killed Jesus and why, we would have to begin our investigation with today's gospel story. Because at the very end of today's gospel story, if you were listening closely, you heard it explicitly said, Mark 11:18, when the chief priests and the scribes heard this, what Jesus had said and done in today's gospel story, they began looking for a way to kill him. In other words, what Jesus said and did in today's gospel story caused the scribes and the chief priests to become so unnerved, they concluded Jesus must be eliminated and within 4 days he would be dead. What happened that was such a decisive turning point on Jesus' journey? If you grew up in church, you've heard today's story told many times. It begins on the first day of the last week of Jesus' life. On a Sunday, Jesus and his disciples made their way into Jerusalem to celebrate the festival of the Passover. We're told that many of Jesus' followers and fans greeted Jesus with great fanfare, waving palm branches and shouting, "Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord." It was on the next morning, Monday morning, we're told that Jesus and his disciples made their way into the temple in Jerusalem, and oh my goodness. Let's just say that Jesus was not amused by what he saw happening there. There were all kinds of booths that had been set up. There were currency traders. There were people who were buying and selling. We're told in the scripture passage that Jesus, I guess the only word for it is Jesus, became irate. He was so disturbed by what he saw, he decided to get in and to make a little bit of good trouble, as John Lewis would say, in a deliberate and provocative act of civil disobedience. We're told, verse 15, Jesus began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. So you get the picture, right? Jesus was upending everything, creating mass commotion. Tables were being turned over. Coinage was being spilled out on the temple floor. Some people were shouting, "You go, Jesus." Other people were shouting, "Stop, that's my property. What do you think you're doing?" To which Jesus shouts back at them, "You have turned my Father's house into a den of thieves." And so when we study this story, we normally jump to the conclusion that what must have made Jesus so angry was that commerce was taking place in the temple. And that's certainly a valid point to draw from this story. None of us wants to go to a church or a spiritual community that's all about money, finance, and commerce. But that is not the main point of today's gospel story. We who live 2,000 years later and aren't familiar with the time and the culture of Jesus fail to understand the full implications of what is taking place in this story. We tend to miss the main point. So, what is it that we're missing? Here's what scholars tell us we need to know to understand the true significance of what Jesus was doing when he cleansed the temple. Take a look at this graphic diagram of the temple as it existed in Jesus' time. The temple that existed in Jesus' time was called Herod's temple because King Herod is the one who funded the reconstruction of the temple. If you look closely at this graph, you'll see near the middle and the top is the temple building proper. It was actually a relatively small building, but then was surrounded by multiple concentric open-air courtyards radiating outward. The entirety of all of these courtyards together with the building were collectively referred to as the temple. Each of these concentric courtyards was itself surrounded by a tall, thick wall. These courtyards served as screening devices, by which I mean as you entered the temple and kept going deeper into the temple, access to these different courtyards became progressively more restricted. For example, as you first entered the temple, you would come into the large U-shaped space that you see labeled as the court of the Gentiles. It was called the court of the Gentiles because, you see, anybody, even a Gentile, even a foreigner, even somebody who was different, even somebody who was spiritually marginalized, unclean people even, were allowed to enter the court of the Gentiles to quiet themselves, to pray, to worship, to listen to rabbis teach, and to seek God in their life. As you proceeded further inward in the temple, you would next come to the court of women. Only Orthodox, observant Jewish men and women were allowed in the court of women. No unbelievers, no unclean people, no foreigners need apply. As you continued even deeper, you would next come to the court of Israel. Only Orthodox, observant Jewish men were allowed in the court of Israel. No women allowed. Next, as you proceeded inward, you would come to the court of the priests. Only priests were allowed in that court. That's where the altar was, where they offered burnt offerings. And then finally, you would come to the temple building itself. And in the very back of the temple building was a small chamber, walled off from the rest of the temple by a thick ornamental curtain. That space, that chamber, was called the Holy of Holies. The Ark of the Covenant was there, and other sacred objects. And in the ancient Israelite way of thinking, this Holy of Holies, this inner sanctum of the temple, was the place on earth where where the intensity of God's presence was most palpable. It was like the earthly throne room of God. Only certain priests, at certain times, for certain very specific purposes, could enter the Holy of Holies, and then only briefly to accomplish a specific task, and after going through elaborate cleansing rituals. Because you see, in the way of thinking that prevailed back then, God could not stand to be in the presence of imperfect people. And even if you were a priest, it was dangerous to enter in to the intensity of the presence of God, because you might have some hidden secret sin. You might have some blemish. You might have some uncleanness that would cause God to be provoked and to strike out at you. That was the ancient understanding of God. And of course, it's not uncommon to encounter that way of thinking about God even in our world today. Some of us may have cut our teeth in churches that consciously or subconsciously taught us to think of God that way. Be afraid. Stay as far away as you can, because it's dangerous to be in the presence of God. Once upon a time, a preacher and his best friend Joe were playing a round of golf. It was a neck and neck round. It was a close contest between them. And on a particularly pivotal hole on the putting green, Joe missed a simple putt. Spontaneously, without giving it much thought, he shouted, "Oh, shoot, I missed," except he used a stronger word, a stronger S word. The preacher was offended and said, "Joe, you're my good friend, but I've got to warn you, you shouldn't use that kind of language. God will get you." On the very next hole, on the very next putting green, Joe missed another simple putt. And again, without giving much thought, shouted out, "Oh, shoot, I missed." The preacher said, "Joe, I'm warning you. You're playing with fire. This is dangerous the way you're talking." On the very last hole, on the very last green, Joe missed the potentially winning putt, and he lost it. He unloaded. "Oh, shoot, 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 I missed it." And just then, a bolt of lightning came down from the sky and struck the preacher. A And Joe hears a booming voice from the heavens saying, "Oh, shoot, I missed." Many of us, sad to say, though we're living 2,000 years into the New Testament era, grew up or cut our teeth in churches that explicitly or implicitly taught us that God is like that. That God would just as soon strike you as look at you. That God is waiting and watching for you to get out of line. That theology that God is dangerous is what guided the architectural design of the ancient temple. Walled courtyards meant to keep ordinary, flawed people at a safe distance from the intensity of the presence of God, and meant to keep unclean people at an even further distance from God. Okay, you can come into the outer courtyard, but no further. That was the layout of the ancient temple design. Missing puzzle piece number one, but there's also a second missing puzzle piece that we need to know, scholars say, to understand the full significance of what's happening in today's gospel story. Because you see, over the course of time, a problem developed. As pilgrims, good, observant, Orthodox Jewish people would travel across the Middle East to come to the Jerusalem temple for high holy festival days like the festival of the Passover. Some would travel for 90 miles, some for 150, hundreds of miles. And when they came to Jerusalem, they wanted to worship in the temple and of course offer a sacrifice to God. But traveling all of that distance with sacrificial animals in a day and time when you traveled on foot or by donkey was a laborious and very difficult task. And so the priests of the temple came up with an idea that for the convenience of these faithful pilgrims who were traveling from afar, they would allow local Jerusalem farmers to set up booths in the temple from which they could sell sacrificial animals to pilgrims who were traveling from afar. But the pilgrims were carrying with them, most of them, Roman currency. Roman currency was considered dirty money. You can't buy a sacred animal to sacrifice with God with dirty money. So it was also necessary to allow money traders, currency exchangers, to set up their operations in the temple so that pilgrims, when they arrived, could give their Roman money to the money traders and get back temple authorized coinage so that they could then purchase their sacrificial animals. So you see, the commerce that was taking place in the temple, it's not like they were selling patio furniture or jewelry or pottery or something like that. They were selling sacrificial animals and exchanging dirty money for clean money. So it wasn't general commerce that was taking place in the temple. It was the kind of commerce that was necessary to support the sacrificial system mandated by the Mosaic law around which the temple had been structured. But finding all of those booths, all of those doves, all of those lambs, all of the currency and all of the currency traders, I mean, that required a lot of space. So where were they going to put all of this? Where would you guess they put it? The priests decided, oh, let's put all that in the court of the Gentiles. Yeah, it'll take a lot of space. Yeah, it'll be a noisy, boisterous, religious bazaar. But who cares about those unclean people? Yeah, it will disturb their worship. Yeah, it's the only place they can go in the temple to worship and seek God. But, I mean, let's face it. If the convenience of the Orthodox observant people requires it, these unclean people, these people who are spiritually marginalized and different, they're expendable. After all, God can barely stand to be in their presence anyway. And when Jesus came into the temple and saw that that was what was taking place, that's what made Jesus furious. Remember, as we've seen in recent weeks, these were Jesus' people. The heart of Jesus was for those who had been spiritually marginalized. He was inviting them to dare to come in to the sacred presence of God. Those who were unclean, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, all of those who were classified as sinners because they were in occupations that didn't allow them to carefully observe all of the Mosaic rules and laws about cleanliness. These were Jesus' people. His heart, his soul was with them. And now he was seeing an attitude of the priests in the temple that was calloused and disregarding toward these people. And that made Jesus angrier than at any other time we witness in the Gospels. And so, with all of that as background, listen again to the words of our gospel passage and see if it doesn't make a lot more sense now. Jesus entered the temple, i.e., the court of the Gentiles, the outer courtyard, and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves and lambs and other sacrificial animals. And then, after Jesus had cleansed the temple, after this forceful, provocative act of civil disobedience, Jesus then tells us why he did it. This is the last critical missing piece of evidence to put this story together. After the outer court was cleansed, we're told in Mark 11:17, Jesus then began teaching and saying, "Is it not written, my house, God's house, shall be called a house of prayer for who? All the nations." All kinds of different people. "But you have made it a den of thieves." Here in what he's saying, Jesus is quoting from the prophet Isaiah. You see, in the Old Testament, Isaiah had looked into the distant future and foresaw a day when he says, Isaiah 56:7, "God's house shall be called a house of prayer for who? All peoples." Isaiah had predicted a day when everybody would be welcome in the temple. And by his forceful act of civil disobedience, Jesus was declaring the time for that prophecy to be fulfilled is now. And what he did so alarmed the Pharisees, so alarmed the priests and the scribes that they concluded, "We'd better get rid of this Jesus while we can." What? You want to let who into the temple? If we lose our power to decide who's in and who's out, we'll no longer have a monopoly on access to God. And then what's going to happen? Then who's going to be in control? The priests saw this as a very threatening action and decided they had to act decisively to stop Jesus while they could. Within a few days, Jesus would be dead. Over a battle for who gets access to God, who gets access to the temple. It's not difficult to see parallels in our culture today. There are many institutional religious leaders in our world today who consciously or subconsciously are playing the same role as those priests in the ancient temple, setting themselves up in a position to say who gets in and who gets out, trying to restrict access to God. People who are different. People who are rough around the edges. People who have problems and don't hide them. People who ask questions, hard questions. People who don't all look alike and dress alike and think alike and act alike. Need not apply. And if you do walk into one of their temples, they'll give you the look. You know the look, right? The one that says, what makes you think you belong here? In his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, Philip Yancey tells a story about a friend of his who works with impoverished people in inner city Chicago. His friend told him about a time a woman who was a prostitute came to him. She was homeless, her health was failing, and her two-year-old daughter had no food. As this counselor was trying to help her figure out how to put her life back together again, at one point in the conversation, he said to the woman, have you ever thought about going to a church for help? Philip's friend told him, I'll never forget the look of absolute astonishment that crossed that woman's face when I said that, as she exclaimed to me, church? Why would I ever go there? They just make me feel even worse about myself. In his book, Befriend, Scott Sauls tells a story about a woman who was a first-time visitor in a church. As she entered the church building that day, she checked her two boys into the nursery and then went into the worship hall. After worship service, she was standing in the line at the nursery to check her two boys out when a nursery worker pulled her aside for a quiet conversation. The nursery worker told her, I thought you'd want to know that both of your boys picked fights with the other kids this morning, and one of your boys broke some of the toys. The woman, the guest, was so embarrassed, she became angry and spontaneously began shouting at her two boys. I mean, she cut loose. She shouted the S word at them in the middle of church. Everybody sort of giving her the look, and suddenly the woman realizes, oh, I've done what I'm not supposed to do here. I can no longer be here. So she grabs her two boys by the hands and rushes out, thinking to herself, I can never go back there again. But not so fast. The nursery worker who had pulled her aside to talk to her felt so terrible about what had happened. She looked up the woman's address, and she sat down and she wrote a note. She sent this note to her. She said, Dear Janet, the visitor, I'm so glad that you and your boys visited our church. Oh, and about that little exchange when you picked them up from the nursery, let's just say I found it so refreshing that you would feel freedom to speak with an honest vocabulary like that in church. I'm really drawn to honesty, and you're clearly an honest person. I hope we can become friends. Love, Jeannie. Janet did come back. In fact, Janet would ultimately become the director of that church's nursery. That's beautiful. That is the Spirit of Christ making room in the temple for everybody. Nobody is above. Nobody is better. Even those of us who've been able to make our way into the inner sanctums of the temple, we have our problems too. It's just that we've learned to be better at hiding our problems. So let's cut the pretending and just authentically welcome everybody as Jesus did. It's like the old joke about Muslims don't recognize Jesus as the Son of God, and Protestants don't recognize the Pope as the leader of the church, and Baptists don't recognize each other in the liquor store. Sad, but true, right? Everybody has problems. Even the holy people have problems. So let's get real. There are so many people in the world today who are hungry and thirsty for churches that are real. Churches that are authentic reflections of the welcome, the radical welcome that Jesus Christ offered. If you don't believe that, just take a look at the response that we've gotten to the sermon that I shared a couple weeks ago about transgender equality. As I shared with you last week, somebody took a 2-minute outtake from that sermon and put it on TikTok, and it went viral, over 100,000 hits and more than 22,000 likes and more than 1,700 shares and more than 900 comments. Listen to some of the comments that people are making in response to that outtake from the sermon. Les Paul wrote, "This made me cry. For the first time in my life, I feel accepted by a Christian." I mean, let that settle in. For the first time in my life, I feel accepted by a Christian. Fetching Fiend wrote, "I would go to this church and I'm not a Christian." User 9265 wrote, "This actually healed some of my religious trauma, seeing a church who actually cares about people who are different." Rachel wrote, "Wow, I'm speechless. This is what I craved to hear back when I used to go to church." Lake Living 2020 wrote, "People would return to churches if this was the message they were hearing." Jason Gill wrote, "This is certainly not Mike Pence's church." I tell you, people are hungry and thirsty for spiritual communities that are authentically reflecting the radical welcome that Jesus Christ offered. As that one person said, people would return to church if that's what they were encountering in church. That principle was so important to Jesus. He was willing to take a daring, risky act of civil disobedience to establish that principle. And that civil act of civil disobedience that Jesus engaged in the temple, that was the immediate precipitating act that triggered the crucifixion of Jesus. But Jesus' protest wasn't done quite yet. Remember that thick ornamental curtain that separated the Holy of Holies, the throne room of God in the temple, from everything and everybody else? 4 days later, on Friday, when Jesus was on the cross, as he approached his end, we're told in Matthew 27:50, Jesus cried again with a loud voice and breathed his last. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. So as his last act of defiance, Jesus tears in two the curtain that kept ordinary people out of the presence of the living God. It's as if Jesus was inviting all of us into the intensity of the presence of God. Because you see, the presence of God is not something to be feared. That's where we find grace. That's where we find healing. That's where we find life. That's why the New Testament goes on to say in Hebrews 4:16, "Let us come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace in time of need." There is nobody, there is no religious leader that has a monopoly on access to God. There is no religious leader who has the right or the power to keep you out of the presence of God. That's the legacy of Jesus. Jesus gave his life to establish that principle. But that doesn't mean there won't be institutional religious leaders, even in our culture today, who try to tell you otherwise. It seems that institutional religion is attracted to that old way of screening people out and controlling access, because that's where institutional religion gets its power. And so it seems in every generation, the same battle has to be fought all over again. Let me close with this. In Glenn MacDonald's writings, he tells about the the epic, he tells about Paolo Veronese's epic painting of the Last Supper. Veronese was one of three of the most famous Venetian artists in the High Renaissance. He was noted for the vivid color that he would use in his paintings at a time when pigments in paint didn't generally produce that kind of color. He was also known for painting ginormous paintings. His Last Supper is 43 feet long by 18 feet high. This is what that painting looks like. And of course, up here on the screen, you can't see the details of the painting, but if you were in Venice and standing in front of the original, 43 feet long by 18 feet tall, you would see that at the Last Supper, Veronese has put not just Jesus and the 12 disciples at this sacred meal, but all kinds of other, shall we say, questionable characters. For example, there are some Roman soldiers playing a dice game in this painting. There's a man with a nosebleed. There are drunkards in this painting at the Last Supper. There's one of Jesus' apostles using a fork to pick his teeth. There's a jester with a parrot on his arm. And there are random stray dogs throughout the painting. When Veronese first unveiled this painting, the institutional religious leaders of the day were not amused. They were scandalized and offended. They told Veronese that he needed to have a conversation with the Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition was the judicial arm of the church at the time that enforced the walls, the boundaries of orthodoxy. As Glenn MacDonald says, when the Inquisition wants to talk to you, that's never a good thing. The Inquisition demanded to know from Veronese, what on earth were you thinking when you put all of these low-life people, when you place them in the sacred meal of the Last Supper in proximity to Jesus? If this is allowed to stand, people might start to get the idea that God actually loves those kind of people. Glenn MacDonald describes what happened next. Veronese pointed out to the Inquisition that it was entirely appropriate to depict Jesus in the presence of lowborn, less than perfect sinners, because according to the Gospels, Jesus routinely attended gatherings with prostitutes, tax collectors, and people who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. The Inquisition was not impressed. They ordered him to repent and to literally repaint. He should immediately paint over all the undesirables. In the spirit of Jesus cleansing the temple, Veronese refused. Good for him. Instead, he told the Inquisition that he was going to retitle his painting. Instead of calling it the Last Supper, he would now call it the Feast in the House of Levi, a reference to a Bible story in Luke chapter 5, where Jesus had dinner with Levi, the tax collector, and many of his unsavory friends. You see, Veronese had outsmarted the Inquisition. They couldn't condemn him for painting a scene that's described in the Gospels themselves. So he got to keep his painting. Oh my goodness. How crazy. In every generation, there will be institutional religious leaders who are determined to reestablish the authority of institutional religion, to screen people out, to say who's in and who's out, to have a monopoly on access to God. Jesus gave his life to challenge that principle, and in every generation, Jesus will keep fighting that, and so should we. We should live lives that reflect the radical welcome of Jesus toward all people. We should live our individual lives that way, and collectively as a congregation, we should be the kind of congregation that reflects the radical welcome of Jesus Christ for everybody, and never, never, never let any religious leader keep you out of the presence of God or tell you that you can't dare to enter the direct presence of God. You walk right through the court of the Gentiles, into and through the court of the Gentiles. You walk into and through the court of the women. You walk into and through the court of the Israelite men, even if you're a woman. You walk into and through the court of the priests, right into the temple building, to the back, to that chamber whose veil was torn. You walk into the Holy of Holies, the throne room of God. And there, instead of hearing, "What are you doing here?" you'll hear God say, "Welcome. I'm so glad that you're here. I was hoping that you would come. I was hoping that you wouldn't let them keep you away." Jesus Christ gave his life to establish that principle. Let's live it.